Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Steve Orich, who is currently in Sarasota, Florida as the orchestrator for Noah Racey's Pulse. And if you've been listening to the last 2 weeks, you heard my interview with Noah and my interview with Jeff Calhoun, who directed Noah Racey's Pulse. So today, I'm playing the interview with Steve Orich, who is the orchestrator of the music for Noah Racey's Pulse, also the orchestrator of the wildly popular and successful Jersey Boys. And I'm going to play not only Steve's interview, but I'm going to replay the review for Noah Racey's Pulse in case you weren't listening last week. And I'm going to play some of the music from Jersey Boys so you can get an idea of Steve's talent as an orchestrator. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down
is about being who you really are so you can live the life you were meant to live. My experience as a psychotherapist has shown me that most of us are not actually being who we really are. We are being a version of who we really are. We are being some of who we really are, but we are not being the whole person. And of course, if you cannot be who you really are, how are you going to live the life that was really meant for you to live? And it is also my belief, as a therapist and also as a person, that the closer you can come to living the life that was really meant for you, and I don't mean this in any metaphysical way, I mean the life that the person that you really are would be most comfortable, would fit most, that is the life that you were meant to live. That you are a person with certain characteristics, certain traits, certain talents, certain skills, and that the more you can use those, the better the life you are living is going to be. So it's, you know, it's obvious, of course, if you are not able to use some of those talents, some of those strengths, some of those abilities, some of those ways of thinking, some of those qualities, then you are diminished to the extent that you don't get access to everything you are. That is how diminished your life is, how unlike the life you were meant to live it is. So again, if you listen to the show, you know that I believe that most of us come out of childhood having to have hidden, denied some parts of ourselves, because those qualities, those aspects, those skills, those natural ways of being just didn't fit. They didn't go down well. They weren't acceptable either to our family of origin, to our school, to our culture, to our religion. And I believe that childhood is mostly about pleasing those people and situations and organizations on which our life depends. So if you figured out pretty early that loud noises scared your mommy, or got a punishment in school, or a criticism in your religious organization, then you began to minimize the circumstances in which you made loud noises. And not only did you then find the way to stop making loud noises altogether, and maybe that wouldn't be such a terrible thing that you were no longer able to make loud noises, although I can think of circumstances in which loud noises enhance what's going on and make you feel better. But okay, fine, maybe you could live without the capacity to make loud noises. But what goes along with the fact that you submerged your ability to make loud noises is the idea that there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me because I want to make loud noises. Because I make loud noises, so I am flawed. I am incorrect. I am not perfect. And this idea is even more insidious to the living the life you were meant to live than the fact that you can't make loud noises. And obviously, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me, I'm pretty sure it's obvious to you too, that this example of making loud noises is standing in for, is metaphorical for, all kinds of other behaviors, activities, ideas. You know, maybe you were encouraged not to cry. Maybe you were encouraged not to become angry. Maybe you were encouraged not to sing. Maybe you were encouraged, as someone I know, only to sing certain kinds of songs and not other kinds of songs, which you might have wanted to sing at some time. Maybe you were discouraged from reading. Maybe you had a dyslexic parent who could not read and who created an idea that reading was somehow bad to protect themselves because they couldn't do it. And so then they pass that on to you. I have heard, I don't know if it's the truth, that a particular tyrant put to death all of his subjects who wore glasses because he suspected them of being intellectuals, and intellectuals were his enemy. So again, people get bizarre ideas and then they act on them. So maybe you were discouraged from reading. Maybe you were discouraged from being the math genius that you are because you're a little girl and your mother thought that it wasn't nice, that little girls shouldn't do that sort of thing. Or maybe you were a little girl whose mommy didn't think it was good for you to excel in sports, because what boy is going to like you if you can beat him on the squash court? Again, all of these things, having to give up any of these things diminishes your life and limits the extent to which you can live the life you were meant to live. And for me, that means it diminishes your capacity for happiness and satisfaction. And in addition, gives you the idea that there's something wrong with you. And that is debilitating. I don't have to explain how that's debilitating. Anyway, The Lynn Show is about making this point, which I have been making now for the last 5 or 6 minutes. I talk about this in every show. Sometimes I talk about it longer than others. You can listen to me talking about this by listening to the other shows, which are all up on my website. The podcasts for all of my shows are up on the website. The website is The Lynn Show, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. All the podcasts are up there. In addition, my book is up there, and of course I talk about this in my book. And the book is When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. Also, there's an email button that you can click if you have questions, you want to talk to me, you want to comment. Also, there's an article up there about psychotherapy on the telephone, which is what I do these days. So if you live anywhere in the world, really, and you want to talk to me, you can go up on the website, click on email me, and tell me you'd like to talk to me, and I'll get back to you, and we can do that. The other thing that I have on the website is all the interviews that I did, some 360-something of them. And they are all with people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because when you listen to people who have dedicated their life in some way to an art, you hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. The psychotherapeutic term for this is congruence. What you hear is what's really there. What you hear is what you got. And when you hear that, it is my hope that just like when I'm talking about the fact that you may have had to hide something about yourself, that you are inspired to wonder about that. To wonder if there's a quality, an attribute, a way of being, an interest. Did you always wonder if you might have been able to be a lawyer or a cobbler or a painter, but you never risked it? Because something inside of you said, oh, that's not going to go down well with something, someone. So it is my hope that The Lynn Show, and specifically the interviews that I play for you, encourage you to ask that question of yourself. And perhaps to pursue what you may have had to deny and essentially have lost access to. Today, I'm playing an interview with Steve Orich, who is a musician. In the context of this interview, we're talking to him as an orchestrator. But actually what he is a man who fell in love with the piano at age 8. You'll hear him tell the story. And this is a man who, the minute he was able to put his hands on a piano, knew who he was and what he needed to do, and had the support from his family, that very important thing, because he found himself in situations where people who were supposed to teach him didn't really understand him and might have damaged him, might have taken his very special gift and undermined it, if he hadn't been so clear about who he was and how he needed to pursue his passion, his love of music, which now he shares with us in so many ways, and currently sharing it with us as the orchestrator of the glorious Pulse, Noah Racey's creation, which is still at the Oslo Repertory Theater Company in Sarasota, Florida, and you can still see it there. And as I'm replaying Sharon Leslie's review of Pulse, and as she says at the end, you know, if you don't get down to see it at the Oslo it's going to cost you a lot of money on Broadway. But you can hear Sharon say that. And, oh, I'm also playing some music from Jersey Boys, in case you haven't seen that. It is still running on Broadway and all over the world. You'll hear Steve talk about how many places it's running and how many people have seen it. I'm going to I can't take my eyes off of you. And at the end, I'm going to play, with whatever time is left, a medley of other tunes. But here, I Can't Take My Eyes Off of You, Steve Orange's orchestration for the Broadway smash musical, Jersey Boys. And following that, my interview with Steve.
Like heaven to touch, I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived, and I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you. Pardon the way that I stay. There's nothing else to compare. The sight of you me weak. There are no words left to speak. But if you feel like I feel, please let me know that it's real. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.
Steve Orange, and Steve is here doing the orchestrations for Pulse, which is the Noah Racy and...
It's the New York Song and Dance Company, it's Noah.
It's Noah.
It's all about Noah.
It's all about Noah.
His Pulse, yes.
It's all, right, okay. Which is at the Oslo Repertory Theater. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I only ask one question.
Okay.
And that is, how did it happen for you? Not when did you get your first job, but when was the first moment in your life, if you can remember? Mm-hmm. Oh, I suppose I ought to say it's implied that since you're doing the orchestrations that your art is music,
mm-hmm.
right? When was the beginning, the first moment that you thought music, singing, tone, that sounds good, I'd like to do that, it's any of that, do you know?
There was not one moment, there were a lot of them along the path. I'll share some.
Yeah. The first one, if you can.
The first one is the apocryphal story that my mom has told for many years, that at 8 years old, we acquired a piano in my house. And it had belonged to a cousin who didn't want it, so they gave it to us. And the piano arrived at our house, and I walked over to it, and I started playing. I put my hands on the keys and started picking out melodies. And that was the first moment everyone sort of looked and was a little bit amazed. After that, I started taking piano lessons.
So now I'm assuming that you don't actually remember that moment.
Not at all.
No, but it must have, something like that must have happened.
There are other moments which I'll share.
Good.
So after that, I started taking piano lessons, but I was very bored with what the teachers were giving me. They said one lesson a week, and they'd give me a book, and by the next week, I'd finished the whole book. Uh-huh. And I was able to play through because I learned how to read music very quickly. So I went through several piano teachers over the course of a few years, and that just wasn't working for me. They didn't recognize what I was doing, so after that, I just taught myself.
You're kidding.
No, and piano. So I've just played, and I played for
you could read.
I knew how to read music. I learned instantly. It was a language that spoke to me on a very special level. I looked at it, and within days, I could read anything.
So. Yeah, right. It you came in with it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of interesting, actually, to me. People like you who come in with a skill can be really, it can be complicated for other people to see it and know what to do with it, you know? And I'm not guessing, you already have said,
yes,
that none of the people who who might have been able to help you really could, because they didn't understand.
Exactly correct. They didn't recognize, maybe I didn't recognize it myself, and neither did my parents, because they had no connection with music in their family. It was just they liked to listen to the radio. But I just had this connection where I liked the path from my eyes to my brain to my fingers, to make that connection of music all the way through, which is what I still do today, except now it goes back the other way. It goes my fingers to my brain, and then I put it on the page for other people to play.
Wow. Okay, all right. So all these abortive piano lessons.
Right.
And then you're playing for fun.
Then I'm playing for fun. And then in school...
Well, how old are you here?
Elementary school. So I start taking drum lessons, and I play drums. And when I get to junior high school, I start taking trumpet lessons. So I'm playing the trumpet also. And then it was the 60s, so I had to play guitar also. So
of course.
I taught myself how to play guitar. So I have little smatterings of all these instruments. So it's time to go to college.
Wait. Okay. I'm going to back you up.
All right, sure.
But I'm assuming, did you play in a band? Or you just were playing for your...
I played for my pleasure, and I also... I played for shows at school. I played rehearsals for shows at school, yeah.
Which instruments did you play?
Just piano.
Just piano.
Yeah, because that's the only thing I was really proficient at. The others I experimented with, but I didn't...
And
really,
played with.
Yeah, but I didn't actually play them in public. So actually, I'll back up. There was another moment. I was 15, and summer was coming, and I looked in the New York Times, and there was an ad saying, wanted musical director for shows at summer camp in the Catskills.
Wow.
So I figured, I'll go try that. So I went in and I met with the director, the person in charge, and I got the job at 15, and I beat out about 10 people who were in their 20s.
I'm sure.
So again, it's a situation where they didn't know what to do with me. Well, you're 15, so you're supposed to be a camper, but you're doing this, but you're not old enough to be a counselor. So I spent 2 summers at different camps in the Catskills.
Where?
One was Camp Mahoji, which was about a mile from where Woodstock took place. And the other one was Camp Orinsaqua outside of Albany.
Ah, what?
And I music directed the shows there, and I loved it, and I played, and it was my first time actually teaching people, running a show, doing that.
You hadn't done that before?
No. I had just played this music, and that's it. So all of a sudden, I'm in charge, so I was a macher. It was very exciting.
Yes, yeah.
So then after that, you're talking about understanding and my level of understanding. So it was time to go to college. So I wanted to go to State University of New York at Stony Brook, which is on Long Island. So I went there, and they said, well, you need to have a classical performance piece, and something of your own liking, and you need to take a series of theory tests.
Uh-oh.
I never studied theory.
Of course not.
But I had looked at music, and I saw that there's a chord that says G7, and I looked and I see, oh, G, B, D, F, those are the notes in that chord. So I sort of figured out from reading the music what the chord symbols meant and other things. Anyway, I went and I studied with a teacher for about 2 months, and I learned the first two movements of the Moonlight Sonata, which I'd never played, but they needed something classical. And they said, play something else, and I had written a variation on the song Soon It's Gonna Rain from the Fantastics. So I played that also, and they asked me questions about it. They said, okay, we're gonna give you a theory placement test. And I went in, and having never taken any theory courses, I placed into fifth semester. They had asked questions, said, okay, now give us figured bass. I said, what do you mean? They said, well, it's a Roman numeral. Like, I said, oh, I understand. And I just went, and they did rhythmic dictation and tonal dictation, and I just...
I just knew it.
I just knew it. Again, it was that same sort of thing.
Right.
So all of a sudden, here I am in school and did that. At school, I spent more time music directing shows than anything else. So I studied composition, I studied conducting, and did that. I never really studied arranging until I got out of Stony Brook. Shall I continue?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I like it. Right. I'm fascinated.
So after that, I moved to New York, and I started playing for off-Broadway shows. And I said, oh, I'm a pianist. My goal in life was to play piano on Broadway. That's what I want to do. So I played for a couple of off-Broadway shows. And then a friend of mine said, there's a really cool arranger who's teaching a course. Do you want to take it? And I said, sure. And this man's name was Don Sebesky, who is an unbelievable arranger orchestrator. He's done hundreds and hundreds of albums, recordings. He won a Tony for orchestrating Kiss Me Kate on Broadway about 10 or 12 years ago. So I took a year-long course with him. And it was at Carnegie Studios above Carnegie Hall. We'd go in every week. And he has a book that he's written called The Contemporary Arranger, which is sort of a Bible of arranging. A lot of people teach with it or use it. But he taught from his book. And we, the first week, he'd, the first couple weeks, we'd talk about the saxophones, and we'd discuss it. And he, we'd go home, and we'd write a piece. And we'd come back in, and he'd bring in Mel Lewis's sax section to play everybody's piece.
Oh my God.
So you get to actually hear your work done by
the top of the line.
Yeah.
Right.
I wrote a solo harp piece, and he brought in the harpist from the New York Philharmonic to play all our pieces. So, but what he did was he taught me how to hear, and that was my big aha moment, because I realized when I played piano, I played like a whole orchestra. I sort of heard the orchestra in my head, and I played high and the low and forceful and emotional and melodic, and I heard all kinds of other lines. He taught me that I could take what I heard in my head and I could put it on paper.
Right.
And he also...
For somebody else to play.
Right, exactly. Which is the better way to do it, because you only have to write it once instead of going it every time.
Well, and however remarkable you are on the piano, there are some things...
There are limitations. You only have 10 fingers.
That's
exactly.
Right.
And he also taught me how to hear in a different way, where I could listen to pretty much any recording, and I could tell you how many instruments, what types of instruments, to such degree where our final exam, which he gave, was he pull up records we'd never heard before, and he said, okay, I'm going to play 30-second clips on these, and each one, tell me, are there 4 strings, 9 strings, 16 strings, or 25 strings playing? And these aren't featured string pieces. It's like a vocal thing with the strings in the background. But I learned how to listen for those things, and I got everyone right. So you just, you...
That's amazing.
Yeah, you gain a sensitivity, because it's not even counting the number. It's a certain type of writing that you write. Not to get too specific, but the fewer the strings, the less... you don't want to write as high with few strings, because you can...
It's thin.
You can hear it. Yeah, you can hear that it's not enough. So with fewer strings, you keep it low. If it's really high, you got to have a lot of strings to support it. So I studied arranging, and I said, this is pretty cool, and I started scoring a couple of independent films in New York, and I was still playing piano for shows off-Broadway and other things. I I toured as music director for a national tour of Godspell. I toured conducting a national tour of Annie. And then finally my break on Broadway comes. It was a show called Baby, written by Richard Maltby and David Shire, and I played the workshop, and then finally I get to play it on Broadway, and I said, this is my dream. I always wanted to be on Broadway.
And here I am.
On Broadway playing this show, 8 shows a week, and I'm bored out of my mind. It's like, wait a second, I just did this yesterday. This is as good as it gets to be exactly the way you were yesterday, and some people really like that. They like the challenge of making it sound fresh, feel fresh to do it or to refine it. I did not enjoy that. So right around then I realized this is not for me. I was spending more time orchestrating, but I started scoring some independent films in New York, and I said, wow, maybe I should go to LA. So I moved to Los Angeles, and basically...
When was it?
1985. And basically worked exclusively as a TV composer for about 15 years.
Wow.
Sitcoms, movies of the week.
And there was a lot of that then.
There was a lot of work.
There's not so much of that now.
Not at all.
But you were there at the time.
It was quite a bit. I did most of the work I did was documentaries. I did probably, I don't know, maybe 15 documentaries, hour long, on all the networks, and that was really enjoyable to me. And some of the shows I did with full orchestra, some I did with small orchestra, and some of them I did at home in my MIDI studio. Around 2001, I heard that they were doing a production at the Pasadena Playhouse of a show called Do I Hear a Waltz, and I happened to be a fan of that show. So I sent a resume to the director and met with him, and he said, I'd love for you to do this. So as it turned out, not only did I music direct and conduct it, but there was some material that needed to be orchestrated. So I got to orchestrate and realize the true thrill of orchestrating your own music and then conducting it live for a show. I don't even know what to compare that to, but if you can think of the greatest thing in your life, whether it's sexual or food or something, that's it. There's nothing better than doing that because it fulfills you
in every possible way.
Yes.
That's right.
So I started doing that, and fortunately that theater only did shows for about 6 weeks, so I didn't stay long enough to get bored. So I did half a dozen or more shows there, in different shows, different capacities, etc. So ask me a question.
Well, I found myself wondering, you didn't say anything about whether your family of origin liked this, understood it, was behind it, didn't get it?
Terrific. My dad was an architect, but at heart he was an artist.
Uh-huh.
He drew, he painted, he did a little bit of sculpting, so he understood art from that level, and supported me emotionally in every way. My mom was the big fan of Broadway musicals.
Aye, aye.
So she had the albums, and she had seen the shows, and she had, so she passed that...
passion.
Obsession, almost, along to me. So and supported me 100% emotionally, whatever I did. So yes, I got total support, even though neither of them really understood music. I don't know if they actually in the end ever really got what I did, but I think they did understand it. The interesting comparison I made to my dad was that he would draw plans on a piece of paper for a house and then give it to people, and they would execute it and create it, and that's basically what I do as an orchestrator.
Right.
I draw an outline or plans of what I want people to play, and then they take them and they play them.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm assuming, but don't let me be, you know, if I'm wrong, that after Do I Hear a Waltz, mm-hmm. you got something of a reputation as not only a musical director, but an orchestrator, is that correct?
Music director / orchestrator for theater, yes, because I started doing several shows there, and that led, actually, the director of that show We did a production in 2007 of Cole Porter's Can Can.
Mm.
So I'll take a little detour now, if you
don't mind. Yeah.
So this was an opportunity to, he was given permission by the Porter estate to completely rewrite the book, which it needed a lot of work because it was an old-fashioned 50s musical, and they gave me free rein with the score. So essentially I cut it up and pasted it back together and put my own personality, created new accompaniments, created new vocal arrangements, dance arrangements, 8 minutes of can-can music, then orchestrated it and conducted it and did it for this production. And it was an enormous success. And by coincidence, just this morning, we have made the announcement, the press out announcement came out, that in July we are doing a workshop of it in New York with Megan Hilty in the lead, and we hope to bring it to Broadway in the spring.
So that's, from your mouth.
Yes, yes, that was the groundwork that led towards that. It moved me back into theater and theater orchestrating, music directing, supervising, conducting, all that together. So yes.
All right. So this just blossomed for you. That's how you, I mean, because I know that you did the orchestrations for Jersey Boys. Mm-hmm. Maybe you just want to say how that happened.
Sure. So it's 2004, and I'm in Los Angeles, and I'm working on several shows. I was supervising a show at Disneyland. I did a show at the Hollywood Bowl. I was conducting 110 in the Shade at Pasadena Playhouse and doing a lot of different things. And I get a call from an old friend from New York named Ron Melrose, who's music director. And we had started out in New York together in the 70s, and we kept in touch and traded work back and forth. And he said, I'm doing a little show. It's at the La Jolla Playhouse. It's just a 5-week run. It's just a little show. They said I can hire anyone I want to orchestrate it, and I want you, if you want the job, it's yours. So I said, what is it? And he said, it's the Four Seasons music. So I ran this by my wife, who has developed a love and appreciation for what I do as well as for theater music, but her roots come from rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And she heard that this was Four Seasons music, and she said, oh my gosh, I don't have to listen to Sondheim anymore. That's wonderful. So she encouraged me to take the job.
A smart woman.
Yes. So we did it at the La Jolla Playhouse, which is only about a 2-hour commute or so from Los Angeles. So I would go there once a week. I'd stay for 2 or 3 days, watch rehearsals, then go back home and orchestrate. I did that for several weeks and then stayed there through band rehearsals, previews, and opening. And 5-week run became 4 months of every performance sold out. And while we were at La Jolla, they raised all the money for the show. They made the album deal, took care of everything. And a year and 2 weeks after we opened in La Jolla, we opened on Broadway.
Wow.
And it was such a phenomenon, just being there, being involved in that, because that was, I call it course correction, that if I'm moving in one direction, I wanted to play piano on Broadway, yes, 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 I'm bored doing that. Maybe I just want to orchestrate, oh, maybe I can score films. But when I came back and orchestrated on Broadway, it all coalesced. It's like, yes, this is it. It's all happened here. So, and that was Jersey Boys, and I got a Tony nomination for it. The show won 4 Tonys. The album won the Grammy. The show has won the Olivier Award in London. They won the Helpman Award in Australia. We've got, I just heard the figure the other day, as of now, 15 million of people around the world have seen the show. And it's still evolving. We have a production opening in Amsterdam in September. We have one opening in Vienna next spring.
And it's the zeitgeist. Everybody wanted this.
You know, and it's funny because they say jukebox musical. I feel like that's a condescending term.
No, not at all.
But because it's not one of those shows where they're just doing a bunch of songs and they build a story around it. We know which one we're talking about, so I won't mention that. But because it tells a real story, and the show works beautifully even without the music. It's so well done. But there were shows like us before and after, but none has, you know, it's luck and timing, and the the collaboration of the people involved, most particularly Marshall Brickman and Rick Ellis, who wrote the book, because they were so clued in and so connected, and we all the other designers created the show around them.
Yeah, I want to say that I see a lot of theater, and I'm embarrassed to say this. I mean, I grew up on musical theater. The first show I saw was Kismet, right? And I love musicals, but I don't love them so much anymore. I mean, I'm very picky now about the musicals I like, and I don't see a lot of them even because, right? And what it was about Jersey Boys was the book. I mean, it's a wonderful, it's what you said.
I agree.
It works without the music.
Yeah.
And then the music, if you grew up with it, just, it's gravy, you know? It's gravy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, okay, good. We don't have to do any more about that. If you haven't seen Jersey Boys yet, what's wrong with you? Okay.
Right.
So you're here now to orchestrate Pulse,
right,
which is Noah Racey's, it's a love letter from Jeff Calhoun to Noah Racey, essentially.
It's a dance show, and I'll back up for a second. Speaking about Marshall Brickman and Rick Ellis, I did another show with them at the Goodman Theater in Chicago in 2008, which was called Turn of the Century, and it starred Jeff Daniels and Rachel York, and it was a terrific show. Unfortunately, we opened in September 2008, and right around then, the producer sort of ran out of money, and we had a trajectory plan for Broadway, and that didn't happen, and we've lost momentum, so that's not going to happen. But the fortunate thing about that show, it was directed by Tommy Toon, and it was choreographed by Noah Racey. So that's where Noah and I met, and we became friends and just developed a respect for one another's work. And about a year ago, I was supposed to do another project, and I was orchestrating and supervising, and I needed a music director to work with me. So I asked around, and I was introduced to someone named Aaron Gandy, who is now the music director for Pulse. And it turned out by coincidence that Aaron had worked with Noah for many years. They'd been friends for a long time. So last summer, I got a call from Aaron. Said, "Hi, I'm here from Noah." He said, "I'm here with Aaron, and we want you to orchestrate a show for us next year." And I said, "Doesn't matter what it is. The answer is yes." And that's how I got here. So we did a workshop in New York in December. And then we started rehearsals a couple weeks ago, and here we are in the thick of it, and I'm furiously writing away at my computer, and finale, our band reading is next Monday, and I'll be ready.
That's great. It's great. What kind of music is it?
It runs the gamut of everything you can imagine. There are classical Broadway dance numbers like Once in Love with Amy. There's existing Broadway music. There's older Irving Berlin type, there's Putting on the Ritz, and then we have a song by Regina Spektor, and we have a song by Keb Moe. So there's a real cross-section, another song by Hall & Oates. So there's a lot of every style, and, you know, Noah creates a mashup of these different styles and different numbers. I know you saw a little bit of a run-through, a press run-through, and you see that the performers have such different styles and looks to them, where you have the classical Broadway type dancers, and then you have two guys that could be truck drivers.
Yes,
and all
right.
of a sudden they're just real amazing hoofers. And Noah, who is Fred Astaire incarnate, because he encompasses all those styles and
a charm.
Oh my gosh, he's so lovely. And as Jeff Calhoun, the director, said at our presentation, this show comes from Noah Racey's pulse. It is what he lives, it's what he thinks, it's what he breathes, and he's simultaneously watching it from the inside and the outside, and looking at the overview and looking at the minutiae at the same time, which is a tough thing to do.
No, he's extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
All right, good. So, I like to ask towards the end of an interview that when someone like you has spent really an entire life, pretty much, you know, 8 years old on, right, in this art, is there anything you'd want to say about what that's like?
When I'm in rehearsal, I often say this, to the people in the cast is, I'm watching you dance a number. But in my head, I hear everything I've written. I hear the whole orchestra without even sitting at the piano because I've created it in my mind. And what I do is I create something in my mind, whatever I want, musically in any way, I create it. And, you know, it's a level of visualization or fantasizing, whatever it is, I manufacture this thing in my head. Some of them just live there and never get out. But sometimes I can take it, and I know how to translate that to put it on a piece of paper so other musicians can look at it and read it, and they play it. And they are putting in the real world what I have had in my mind, and that's that intensely fulfilling experience.
It's so gorgeous. It's really gorgeous. It's a great way to stop. Thank you very much, Steve.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's an intensely fulfilling experience. Even if Steve hadn't said those words, we might have known that what he is able to do with his life is intensely fulfilling for him. He is living the life he was meant to live. The life he discovered he was meant to live at around 8 years old when the universe was kind enough to drop a piano in his house. So when you listen to Steve, you can hear the way he was always able to run the decisions that he made through himself. Does this work for me? Is this right for me? Does this feel good to me? Well, boy, what I think I want to do is play on Broadway. Oh, here I am doing what I thought I wanted to do. I got it. Oh, well, I didn't have enough information. Turns out, this isn't exactly what I want to do. This doesn't exactly work for me. And not, oh, well, you know, what can I do? Here I am. But more and more and over, asking himself, does this work for me? Is this me? Not, do I have to endure this, settle for it, accept it? And that, the willingness to say, I mean, that whole thing with the teachers who couldn't get him, how many of us would have just stayed there, trying to be a good little boy or girl, trying to do what somebody else said you were supposed to be doing? That is the way to deny yourself. That is the way to make essentially sure that you're not going to be living your life, the life you were meant to live. So as I said in the beginning, it is my hope that when you listen to people like Steve, you hear what it sounds like, and you hear how good it feels to have intensely fulfilling experiences in your life. You don't have to be an orchestrator on Broadway to have intensely fulfilling experiences in your life. You just have to be you. So, as I said, it is my hope that when you listen to Steve and everybody else, and if you listen to Jeff or Noah last week, you hear the same thing. You hear the delight, the passion. And if you listen next week to Tobin, you will hear it again. And ironically, all four of these guys are what makes Noah Racy's pulse what it is, which is just an extraordinary experience in theater. And I'm going to let you listen to Sharon Leslie's reviews, so not you don't have to take my word for it. And actually, I think I'll do that right now. So here is Sharon Leslie talking about Noah Racy's pulse. Double wow, triple wow. Noah Racy's pulse at the Oslo Repertory Theater is a bombshell of a musical work. Contemporary yet traditional, flashy yet minimalist. Its appeal relies solely on the talents of the performers and not technological hocus pocus. I gotta say, what a welcome and celebratory change of pace in our overblown world of comic book or wizardry heroes on screen and on the stage. Here are real people who have spent years of practice and passionate drive to become accomplished virtuosos in their art, just doing and sharing their thrilling art with joy. I was beginning to think that personality and human bravura were going to be totally overshadowed by computer gimmickry. Essentially, Pulse is a review, a pastiche of mostly familiar tunes by Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, George M. Cohan, with more contemporary songs like Rich Girl by Hall & Oates and You Can Love Yourself by Kip Moe, and some rap. Oh, did I say there was tap dancing? Is there ever tap dancing? Pulse is a fireworks display of tap dancing with nods to Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, with and without Leslie Caron, the Nicholas Brothers, and Gregory Hines. The night is a celebration of rhythms danced by the feet, as is referenced right off with the second song, quote, educate your feet, unquote. Then, celebrated in various ways with the band. Even the performers play on a variety of homegrown implements, like spoons and the washboard, or show off sounds made by the mouth, and even the body gets played as percussionist Jason Udoff does so entertainingly. The great star of the night is the charming Noah Racey. He is an unabashed song and dance man who reminds me of a contemporary Fred Astaire, only handsomer. But then again, he could be more in the style of Gene Kelly, since he never wears a tux. He sings with a charming simplicity that allows the song and the sentiment of the lyric to shine, that is a most welcome contrast to the overwhelmingly Baroque styling of Christina Aguilera and her like. His grace, virtuosity, and imaginative use of choreography. Oh yeah, he also wrote and choreographed the piece. Because he is such a great performer, he could utilize the various strengths of his own dancing and that of his fellow performers to show stopping excellence. Obviously, this is a rave, but with good reason. Besides the amazing execution of the various virtuoso dance passages, Racey imaginatively employed change-up rhythms, looks, use of floor space, theatrical stunts, and even taking his tap shoes off and having them dropped in from overhead. All the performers were of the highest caliber, and each had featured moments. Francis Bradley sang and danced a beautiful rendition of I Got You Under My Skin. Laura Lynn McClelland sang a haunting Eat and danced a lyric duo with Racey in another number. Christopher Irk, Danny Gardner, and Antonio Russo all had moments of individual dance spectacularisms. I think that's a new word. And when they danced as a unit, they were all sharp, crisp, and on the money, quite literally at one time. The look of the show is minimalist. The direction of the piece by Jeff Calhoun is theatrical and yet intimate. The seven-piece band plays on stage behind a well-worn wooden dance floor. The backdrop is a polka-dot wall of lights that vary in color throughout the performance. The wall of lights is echoed by two traveling panels of girds of lights, while the floor is surrounded by floor lights. It's an old, but at the same time, a modern look. No high-tech revolving, quote, American Idol, unquote, lights here. These guys are pros, not wannabes. The casual costumes are flashy, yet understated with jeans, suits, colorful t-shirts, clothes you might see on the street. There is nothing better in the world than to see great performances by inspired artists. I hope you make the time to see Noah Racey's Pulse at the Oslo Conservatory Theater. If not, you'll have to pay a fortune to see it on Broadway. It deserves to be there and all over the world. Okay, so as I am running out of time, it is time for me to, as I always do at the end of my shows, talk about Josh Hackney, who is the IT savior who makes it possible for me not only to do this show, but to do almost everything else. I don't know how it is for you, but so much of the technology which I now have to use in order to do what I want to do, I don't know how to use, or I didn't know how to use. It's all new learning for me. It's all learning curves. And I'm not spontaneously, easily able to figure out how to do what needs to be done. For example, when I started to do this show, I needed to have software which would allow me to record in it and to upload things like the songs you just heard or will hear, and the interview. I needed software to upload the interview from the digital recorder to the computer and then from that software to the other software. I didn't have a clue how to do that. Josh found all of the softwares and taught me how to use them. And when something new is required, or when I have forgotten because it's something I haven't used in a long time, he's able to remind me. So it's not only that he is as skilled as he is, it is that he is kind. I do not know what your relationship to the technology is, but if there is any way in which you need to learn to be brought up to speed, or just to have somebody do this stuff for you, which is also happens here a lot, you want Josh. And he can do this for you on the telephone. He quite often does that for me. Or if you happen to be in South Florida, he can come to you, which is also a treat. Anyway, Josh Hackney, you can get him at my website, thelynnshow.com, the way you can get me, and the way you can listen to this interview and all the other interviews and past shows. So, we're going to go out on as much as I have time for of the medley of songs from Jersey Boys. And as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that you didn't know, something that intrigued you, something that made you tap your toe, as I did listening to the Jersey Boys again. Something that'll bring you back, because I will be here next week, and boy, I hope you will be too.
There ain't no good in our goodbye. True love takes a lot of trying. Oh, I'm crying. Let's hang on to what we got. Don't let go, girl. We got a lot. Got a lot of love between us. Hang on, hang on, hang on to what we got. Do 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 do. You say you're gonna go and call it quits. Gonna chuck it all and break our love to bits.
Break it up.
I wish you'd never said
it. Break
it up. No, no, we'll both regret it. Baby,
don't you go.
Baby,
oh, no, no.
Baby,
let's stay. Let's hang on.
Let's hang on.
To what we got.
To what we got.
Don't let go.
Oh, girl, we got a lot. Got a lot of love between us. Hang on, hang on, hang on to what we got.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseen.